She tried a smile, then began another one. He realised that she was unsure of him, nervous even. He navigated his way across the table to touch her hand, because frankly neither of them was good with those sort of words, nor were they young enough to have the patience to fumble through them.
I can't believe how fragile he looks.
The future, or lack of it, decided by the fate of that metal egg. Tatty, patched, and from this vantage point, how small the Gilgamesh looked. They ate thoughtfully, Lane progressing from brief moments where she talked far too fast, trying to force on a conversation for the patent reason that she felt they should be having one, then subsiding into longer stretches of companionable quiet. At last Holston grinned at her, out of one of those periodic silences, feeling the youth of the expression stretch his face.
This is good.
I hope it is. We're shipping tons of the stuff over to the Gill.
I don't mean the food. Not just that.
Thank you. After they had eaten, and with the rest of Lane's crew tactfully out of sight and out of mind, they retired to another room she had carefully prepared. It had been a long time since their previous liaison on the Gilgamesh. It had been centuries, of course. Long, cold, spacefaring centuries. But it seemed a long time also. They were part of a species that had become unmoored from time, only their personal clocks left with any meaning for them, while the rest of the universe turned to its own rhythms and cared nothing for whether they lived or died. There had been those back on Earth who claimed the universe cared and that the survival of humanity was important, destined, meant. They had mostly stayed behind, holding to their corroding faith that some great power would weigh in on their behalf if only things became so very bad. Perhaps it had. Those on the Ark ship could never know for sure. Holston had his own beliefs, though, and they did not encompass salvation by any means other than the hand of mankind itself.
"What's he after?"
Lane asked him later, as they lay side by side beneath a coverlet that had perhaps been some ancient terraformer's counterpane thousands of years before.
"I don't know."
"I don't know either," she frowned. "That worries me, Holston. He's even got his own engineers doing all the work, you know that. He took his pick from the cargo, woke up a bunch of second stringers and made them his own personal tech crew. Now they're installing all that stuff you're helping him with, fitting the Gill with it, and I don't know what it does. I don't like having things on my ship that do things I don't know about."
"Are you asking me to betray the Commander's trust?"
Holston was joking as he said it, but then he was suddenly stung by the thought. "Is that what this is about?" Lane stared at him.
"Do you think that?"
"I don't know what to think."
"What this is about, old man, is me wanting to scratch an itch without messing up the way my crew works. And..."
He could hear her trying to harden the edge in her voice and hear it crack a little, even as she did so.
"And, you know what? I've been on my own a lot over the last... 200 fucking years, is what? I've been on my own, walking around the Gill and keeping him together. Or with some of my crew sometimes to fix stuff. Or sometimes Guyan was there. Like, that's better than being on your own. And there was all that mad stuff. The mutiny, the planet. And I feel like I forget how to talk to people sometimes when it's not the job. But you..." Holston raised an eyebrow. "You're fucking awful at talking to people too," she finished viciously. "So maybe when you're around it doesn't feel so bad. Thank you very much."
"You're welcome."
"Guyan's thing, it's for uploading people's brains into a computer."
It felt oddly good for him to no longer be the sole custodian of that information. Otherwise, only Guyan knew, as far as Holston was aware. Even his tame engineers were just working to rote, each on their own piece. Lane considered that.
"I'm not sure if that's a great thing."
"It could be very useful." Holston's tone of voice did not even convince himself. Lane nearly made a sound. Not a word. Not anything, really. Just to show she'd heard him. It left Holston turning over in his mind what little he had learned about the device from the technical manuals Guyan had set him to work on. They had all been written for people who already knew what the device did, of course.
There was no handy moment when the authors had stopped and gone back to explain the basics for their unthinkably distant monkey descendants. Holston was becoming sure that he now knew what the upload facility was, though. More, he thought that he might have seen the result of one, and what happened when someone was mad enough to make themselves its subject. For out there, in the distant dark around another world, in her silent metal coffin, was Dr. Avrana Kern. Chapter 4.8 Age of Progress. Ever afterwards, Bianca has suffered from momentary fits, stumblings in speech and gait, sudden epilepsies when she is cut adrift from her surroundings for varying periods of time, her legs drumming and spasming as if trying urgently to impart a message in some idiolectic code. But she has survived the plague, and when a fit is not upon her, retained her mind. For Viola, whose biochemical genius furnished the means, the cure came too late. Many others, great minds, great warriors, leading females of peer houses, starving males in the gutter, all have been struck down. Great Nest has been saved, but thousands of its inhabitants were not so lucky. Other cities were similarly affected, even with production of the cure taking over the work of every suitable ant colony, and the theoretical basis being sung down the lines that link the spider communities together. The disaster has been averted, but narrowly. It is now a new world, and Portia's people recognize the fragility of their place in it. A great many things are poised on the point of change. It is not Portia herself who first grasps the wider import of her cure. It is hard to say which scientist was first to the mark. It is one of those ideas that seems simultaneously to be everywhere, exciting every inquiring mind. Portia's treatment has allowed living adult spiders to benefit from a foreign understanding. Yes, what was transferred was an immunity, but surely the process would work with other understandings, if they can only be separated out and their page noted in Viola's great book of the body. No longer will the spread of knowledge be held down by the slow march of generations, or by laborious teaching. The need for this technology is great. The depredations of the plague have made understandings hard to find. Where once a given idea might be held within scores of minds, now there are just a handful at best. Knowledge has become more precious than ever. It is only a few years after the plague that the first idea is transferred between adults. A somewhat garbled understanding of astronomy is imparted to a male test subject, as are all such, given some failures in earlier experiments. From there on, any spider may learn anything. Every scientist of Portia's generation and beyond will stand on the shoulders of the giants that she chooses to reside within her. What one knows, any can know, for a price. An economy of modular, tradable knowledge will swiftly develop. But that is not all. After she is recovered, Portia presents Bianca to the temple. She explains about her fellow's contribution to the cure. Bianca is permitted to address the assembled priestesses. There has been a shift of orthodoxy in the wake of the plague. Everyone is having to stretch their minds to fill the gaping void left by all those who did not survive. Old ideas are being revisited, old prohibitions reconsidered. There is a great feeling of destiny, but it is a self-made destiny. They have passed the test. They are their own saviours. They wish to communicate something to that one point of intellect outside their sphere, the most basic, essential signal. They wish to tell the messenger, "We are here." Bianca's battery, in and of itself, does not make a radio transmitter. Whilst the experiments with the transmission of understandings between spiders progress, so does the investigation into the transmission of vibrations across the invisible web that is strung from their world to the distant satellite and beyond. Years later, an aging Bianca and Portia are amongst a crowd of the intimates of the temple, now ready to speak to the unknown, to cast their electromagnetic voice into the ether. The replies to the messenger's mathematical problems, that every spider knows and understands, are ready for transmission. They wait for the messenger to appear in the night sky above, and then they send that unequivocal first transmission. We are here. Within a second of the last solution being sent, the messenger ceases its own transmissions, throwing the whole of Portia's civilization into a panic that their hubris has angered the universe. Several fraught days later, the messenger speaks again. Chapter 4.9 Ex Machina. The signal from the green planet resonated through the Bryn 2's sentry pod like an earthquake. The ancient systems had been waiting for just this moment, it seemed forever. Protocols laid down in the days of the old empire had gathered dust through the ages, through the entire lifespan of the new species that was even now announcing its presence. They had grown corrupted. They had lost their relevance, been overwritten, been infiltrated by the diseased spread of the uploaded Kern persona that the sentry pod had been incubating like a culture all these years. The systems received the signal, checked over the sums, and found them within tolerance, recognized that a critical threshold had been passed with respect to the planet below. Its purpose, rusty with eons-long disuse, was abruptly relevant again. For a recursive, untimed moment, the systems of the sentry pod, the sea of calculation that boiled behind the human mask of Eliza, were unable to make a decision. Too much had been lost, misfiled, edited out of existence within its mind. It attacked the discontinuities within its own systems. Whilst it was not truly a self-aware artificial intelligence, it nevertheless knew itself. It restored itself, worked around insoluble problems, reached the right conclusion by estimate and circuitous logic. It did its best to awaken Avrana Kern. The distinction between living woman, uploaded personality construct, and pod systems was not finely drawn. They bled into one another, so that the frozen sleep of the one leaked nightmarish dreams into the cold logic of the others. A lot of time had passed. Not all of Avrana Kern remained viable. Still, the pod did its best. Dr. Kern awoke, or she dreamt of waking, and in her dream, Eliza hovered at her bedside like an angel and provided a miraculous annunciation. This day is a new star seen in the heavens. This day is born a savior of life on Earth. Avrana fought with the trailing weeds of her horrors, struggling to resurface enough to understand what was really being told to her. She had not been truly conscious for some time. Had she ever been? She had confused recollections of some dark presence, intruders attacking her charge, the planet below that had become her purpose, the sum total of her legacy. A traveller had come to steal the secret of her project, to rob her of the immortality represented by her new life, by her progeny, by her monkey children. Had it? Or had she dreamed it? She could not separate the fact from the long, cold years of sleep. "I was supposed to be dead," she told the watchful pod. "I was supposed to be locked away, oblivious. I was never supposed to dream." "Doctor, the passage of time appears to have led to a homogenization of information systems within the sentry pod. I apologize for this, but we are operating beyond our intended parameters." The sentry pod was designed to lie dormant for centuries. Avrana remembered that much. How long would it take, the virus, to spark intellect into generations of monkeys? Did that mean that her experiment was a failure? No, they had signaled at last. They had reached out and touched the ineffable. And time was suddenly no longer the currency it once had been. She remembered now why she was in the sentry pod at all, performing this function that had been meant for someone far more disposable. Time didn't matter. Only the monkeys mattered, because the future was theirs now. Yet those troubling half-dreams recurred to her. In her dream, there had come a primitive boat of travellers claiming to be her kin,
but she had looked at them and seen them for what they truly were. She had scanned through their histories and their understandings. They were the mould that had grown on the corpse of her own people. They were hopelessly corrupted with the same sickness that had killed Kern's own civilization. Better to start anew with monkeys.
"What do you want of me?"
she demanded of the entities that surrounded her. She looked into their faces and saw an infinite progression of stages between her and the cold logic of the pod systems, and nowhere could she say where she herself ended and where the machine began. "Phase two of the Uplift Project is now ready," Eliza explained. "Your authority is required to commence."
"What if I died?" Avrana choked out. "What if I'd rotted? What if you couldn't wake me?"
"Then your uploaded persona would inherit your responsibilities and authority," Eliza replied. And then, as if remembering that it was supposed to show a human face, "But I am glad that has not occurred."
"You don't know what glad means."
But even as she said this, Kern was not sure that it was true. There was enough of her smeared up that continuum towards the life electronic that perhaps Eliza knew more of human emotion than Kern herself was now left with.
"Proceed with the next phase. Of course, proceed with the next phase,"
she snapped into the silence that followed.
"What else are we here for? What else is there?"
In a very real sense indeed, what else is there? She remembered when the false humans, that disease that had outlived her people, had approached the planet. Had they? Had that actually happened? She had spoken to them. The her that had interacted with them must have recognized enough humanity in them to bargain, to spare them, to allow them to rescue their own. Each time she was awoken, it seemed some different assortment of thoughts took the helm of her mind. She had been in a giving vein then. She had recognized them to be human enough to show mercy to. She had been sentimental that day. Thinking back on it, she regained those memories of how it had felt. And they had been as good as their word, she assumed. And they had gone. There was no sign of them, or of any transmissions, within the solar system. She had an uncomfortable feeling that it was not that simple. She had a feeling that they would be back. And now she had so much more to lose. What devastation would those false humans wreak on her nascent monkey civilization? She would have to harden her heart. Phase two of the Uplift program was a contact exercise. Once the monkeys had developed their own singular culture to the extent that they could send radio transmissions, they were ready for contact with the wider universe. And now I am the wider universe. The sentry pod would begin developing a means of communication, starting with the simplest binary notation and using each stage to bootstrap up to a more complex language, just as if a computer was being programmed from scratch. It would take time, depending on the willingness and ability of the monkeys to learn generation to generation. But first, send them a message, Avrana decided. For all that the inhabitants of the planet could not possibly understand her, right now she wanted to set the tone. She wanted them to understand what they were in for when she and they could finally communicate. "Awaiting your message," Eliza prompted.
"Tell them this," Avrana declared.
Perhaps, in their simian ignorance, they would record it and later reread it and understand it all.
"Tell them this. I am your creator. I am your god."
Part 5. Schism. Chapter 5.1. The Prisoner. Holston was pondering his relationship with time. Not long ago, it seemed that time was becoming something that happened to other people, or, as other people had then been in short supply, to other parts of the universe. Time was a weight that he seemed to have been cut free from. He stepped in and out of the forward path of its arrow, and was somehow never struck down. Lane might call him old man, but in truth the span of objective time that had passed between his nativity and this present moment was ridiculous, unreal.
No human ever bestrode time as he had done, in his journey of thousands of years. Now, in his cell, time weighed him down and dragged at his heels, chaining him to the grindingly slow pace of the cosmos, where before he had leapt ahead across the centuries, skipping between the bright points of human history. They had hauled him from the suspension chamber and thrown him in this cage. It had been 27 days before anyone gave him even an indication of what was going on. At first, he thought it was a dream of the mutineers kidnapping him. He had been quite sanguine before he realized that the people dragging him through the Gilgamesh were not the long-dead Skulls and company, but total strangers. Then he had entered the living quarters. The smell had assailed him. An utterly unfamiliar, sick reek that even the gill's ventilation had not been able to purge. It was the scent of close-packed human habitation. He had a blurred recollection of a former operations room, now festooned with grey cloth, a veritable shanty town of makeshift drapes and hangings, and close partitions and people, lots of people. The sight had shocked him. Some part of him had grown comfortably used to being part of a small and select population, but he registered at least 100 unfamiliar faces in that brief moment. The press of them, the closeness of their living conditions, the smell, the sheer raucous noise, all of it merged into the sense of confronting a hostile creature, something fierce and inimical and all-consuming. There had been children. His wits had started to come to him by then, with the thought, the cargo's got loose. His captors all wore robes of the same sheer grey material that the squatters were also using for their amateurish tents, something that the Gilgamesh had presumably been storing for some other purpose entirely, or that had been synthesized in the workshops. Holston had spotted a few ship suits during his hurried passage through the living quarters, but most of the strangers had been wearing these shapeless, sagging garments. They were all thin, malnourished, underdeveloped. They wore their hair long, very long, past the shoulders. The whole scene had a weirdly primal feel to it, a resurgence of the primitive days of mankind. They had seized him, locked him up. This was not just some room in the gill that they had secured. Within one of the shuttle bays they had welded together a cage, and this had become his home. His captors had fed him and sporadically removed the pail provided for his other functions, but for 27 days that was all he had. They seemed to be waiting for something. For his part, Holston had eyed the shuttle airlock and begun to wonder if his future did not include some kind of space god sacrifice. Certainly the manner of his captors was not simply that of oppressors or kidnappers. There was a curious respect, almost reverence, to be observed amongst some of them. They did not like to touch him. Those who had manhandled him to the cage had worn gloves, and they refused to meet his eyes. All this reinforced his growing belief that they were a cult, and he was some sort of sacred offering, and that the last hope for humanity was even now vanishing away beneath the tide of superstition. Then they set him to work, and he realized that he must surely be dreaming. One day, he woke up in his cell to find that his captors had brought in a mobile terminal. A poor, lobotomized sort of a thing, but at least a computer of sorts. He leapt on it eagerly, only to find it linked with nothing, entirely self-contained. There was data there, though, files of familiar proportions written in a dead language that he was frankly coming to loathe. He looked up to find one of his captors peering in. A thin-faced man, at least a decade younger than Holston, but small-framed like most of them, and with pockmarked skin suggesting the aftermath of some manner of disease. As with all these bizarre strangers, he had long hair, but it was carefully plaited and then coiled at the back of his neck in an intricate knot. You must explain it. It was the first time any of them had spoken to Holston. He had begun to think that he and they shared no common language. Explain it, Holston repeated neutrally. Explain it so it can be understood. Make it into words. This is your gift. Oh, for... You want me to translate it? Even so. I need access to the Gill's main systems. Holston stated. No. There are translation algorithms I wrote. There are my earlier transcriptions I'll need to refer to. No. You have all you need in here. With great ceremony, the robed man pointed at Holston's head. Work. It is commanded.
Commanded by whom? Holston demanded.
Your master. The robed man stared coldly at Holston for a moment, then suddenly broke off his gaze, as though embarrassed. You will work, or you shall not eat. This is commanded, he muttered. There is no other way. Holston had sat down at the terminal and looked at what they wanted from him. That was the beginning of his understanding. Obviously, he was dreaming. He was trapped within a dream. Here was a nightmarish environment, both familiar and unfamiliar. Here was a task without logic that was nonetheless the cracked mirror of what he had undertaken when last awake, when the Gilgamesh had been in orbit over the grey planet. He was in the suspension chamber still, and dreaming. But, of course, one did not dream in suspension. Even Holston remembered enough about the science to know that. One did not dream because the cooling process brought brain activity to an absolute minimum, a suspension of even the subconscious movements of the mind. This was necessary because unchecked brain activity during the enforced idleness of a long sleep would drive the sleeper insane. Such a situation arose out of faulty machinery. Holston remembered clearly that they had lost human cargo already. Perhaps this is how it had been for those martyrs. It was a strangely calming revelation to know that his suspension capsule must be failing at some deep mechanical level, and that he was lost inside his own mind. He tried to imagine himself fighting with the sleeping chamber, crawling up the steep incline of ice and medication so as to wake up, beating on the unyielding inside of the coffin, buried alive within a ship-shaped monument to mankind's absurd refusal to give up. None of it got the adrenaline going. His mind stubbornly refused to leave that makeshift cell in the shuttle bay, as he worked slowly through the files he had been left with. And of course it was a dream, because they were more of the same. More information about Guyan's machine, the upload facility the man had wrenched whole from the abandoned terraform station. Holston was dreaming an administrative purgatory for himself. Days went by, or at least he ate and slept and they slopped out his pail. He had no sense of anything functional happening outside the cage. He could not see what these people were for, save living day to day and forcing him to translate and producing more of themselves. They seemed a weirdly orphan population, like lice infesting the Ark ship, that the Gill might any moment purge from its interiors. They must have begun life as cargo, but how long ago? How many generations? They continued to regard him with that curious reverence, as though they had caged a demigod. It was only when they came to shave his head that he fully understood that. They, none of them, seemed to cut their hair, but it was important to them that his scalp was cropped back to fuzz. It was a sign of his status, his difference. He was a man of an earlier time, one of the originals. As is Vri Guyan. The unhappy thought finally dispelled his somewhat fond thought that this might all be some hibernation nightmare. Wading his way through tangled philosophical treatises concerning the implications of the upload process, he had a window into Guyan's tightly clenched, control-hungry mind. He began to assemble the sketchiest possible picture of what might be going on, of what might have gone wrong, therefore. Then one day they opened his cage, a handful of robed figures, and led him out. He was not finished on his current project, and there was a tension about his keepers that was new. His mind immediately boiled with all manner of potential fates they could be intending for him. They moved him out of the hangar and into the corridors of the Gilgamesh, still not speaking. They seemed to lack the show of reverence in which they had previously held him, which he reckoned could not bode well. Then he saw the first bodies. A man and a woman collapsed in their path like string-cut marionettes, the textured floor sticky with a slick of blood. They had been hacked at with knives, or at least that was Holston's impression. He hurried on past them, his escorts, captors, paying no obvious heed to the dead. He tried to question them, but they just hauled him along quicker.
He considered struggling, shouting, protesting, but he was scared. They were all solidly made people, bigger than most of the grey ship lice he had observed so far. They had knives in their belts, and one had a long plastic rod with a blade melted into the end. These were the ancient tools of the hunter-gatherers, remade from components torn from a spaceship. It had all been handled so swiftly and confidently that only right at the end did he realise that he had been kidnapped, wrested from one faction by another. At once, everything became worse than he had thought. The Gilgamesh was not just crawling with crazy descendants of awoken cargo, but they had already begun fighting each other. It was the curse of the old empire, that division of man against man that was the continual break on human progress. He was hustled past sentries and guards, or so he took them to be, men and women, some in ship suits, some in makeshift robes, others in piecemeal homemade armour, as though at any moment someone would be arriving to judge the world's least impressive costume competition. It should have been ridiculous. It should have been pathetic. But looking into their eyes, Holston was chilled by their steely purpose. They brought him into one of the ship's workshop rooms, housing a score of terminals, half of them dead, the rest flickering fitfully. There were people working on them, real technical work befitting real civilized people. And it looked to Holston as though they were fighting for control, engaged in some colossal virtual battle on an invisible plane. At the far end of the room was a woman with short-cut hair, a little older than Holston. She wore a ship suit that had been fitted out with plastic scales and plates, like somebody's joke idea of a warrior queen, if only she had not looked so very serious. There was a ragged, healed scar about her chin, and a long pistol was thrust through her belt, the first modern weapon Holston had seen. "Hello, Holston," she said. And his interpretation of what he was seeing suddenly flipped like a card turning over. "Lane?" he demanded. "Now you've got that look on your face," she observed, after giving him enough time to get over his surprise. "That one that's sort of, I have no idea what's going on. And frankly, I can't seriously believe that. You're supposed to be the smart guy, after all. So how about you tell me what you know, Holston?" She sounded partly like the woman Holston remembered, but only if that woman had been living hard and rough for some time. He gave the request due consideration. A lot of him genuinely wanted to disavow any knowledge. But she was right. That would be self-serving mendacity. "I'm just a poor academic doing what I'm told. I'm not responsible." He was beginning to think that he was indeed, in part, responsible. Responsible for whatever was happening now.
"Guyon's taken over," he hazarded.
"Guyon's the commander. He's already, what, over? Come on, Holston." "He's woken up a whole load of cargo." Holston glanced at Lane's villainous-looking crew. Some of them he thought he recognised as her engineers. Others could well be more of the same cargo that Guyon had apparently now pressed into service.
"I guess he started on that a while ago. Looks like there may be 2-3 generations down the line. Is that even possible?"
"People are good at making more people," Lane confirmed. "Fuckwit never thought that one through. Or maybe he did. They're like a cult he's got. They know fuck all but what he's told them, yeah? Any of the originals from Cargo who might have argued, they're long gone. These skinny little creeps were basically raised on stories of Guyon. I've heard some of them talking, and they're fucked up, seriously. He's their saviour. Every time he went back into suspension, they had a legend about his return. It's all kinds of messianic shit with them." She spat disgustedly. "So tell me for why, Holston." "He had me working on the upload facility taken from the station." A little of the academic crept back into Holston's unsteady tones. "There was always a suggestion that the ancients had found out how to store their minds electronically. But the EMP phase of their war must have wiped the caches out, or at least we never found any of them. There's very little that's even peripheral reference.
It didn't seem to be a standard immortality trick.
Oh, spare us, Lane broke in.
So yes, Guyon wants to live forever.
Holston nodded. I take it you're not in favour.
Holston, it's Guyon. Forever. Guyon, forever. Two words that do not sit well together.
He glanced at her confederates, wondering if things here in Lane's camp had got to the point where dissent was punishable.
Look, I understand it's not the most pleasant idea, but he's got us this far. If he wants to load his mind into some piece of ancient computing, then are we definitely sure that's something worth, you know, killing people over?
Because Holston was still thinking a little about those crumpled bodies he had seen, the price of his freedom. Lane put on an expression to show that she was considering this viewpoint.
Sure, fine, right. Except two things. One, I only got one look at his new toy before he and I had our falling out. But I don't reckon that thing's a receptacle for minds. It's just the translator. The only place he can go is the Gilgamesh's main system. And I seriously do not think that it's set up to keep doing all of its ship running with a human mind shoved into it. Right?
Holston considered his relatively extensive understanding of the upload facility.
Actually, yes, it's not a storage device, the thing we took from the station. But I'd thought he'd got something else from there.
And have you seen any of your old files that suggest he has?
A grimace.
No.
Right. Lane shook her head. Seriously, old man. Did you not think about what it was all meant for, when you were doing his work?
Holston spread his hands.
That's unfair. It was all... I had no reason to think there was anything wrong. Anyway, what's your second thing?
What?
Two things, you said. Two reasons.
Oh, yes. He's completely nutbucket crazy. So that's what you're diligently working to preserve. An utter god-complex lunatic.
Guyon?
Yes, a bit of a tyrant, but he had the whole human race in his hands.
Yes, not an easy man to work with, someone who kept his plans to himself. Lane, I know that you and he...
don't get on?
Well, Holston, he's been busy. He's been busy for a very long time since we left the Grey Planet. He's set up his fucking cult and brainwashed them into believing he's the great hope of the universe. He's got this machine mostly up and running. He's tested it on his own people. And believe me, that's not gone well, which is why it's still only mostly up and running.
But he's close now. He has to be.
Why has to be? Because he looks like he's a fucking 100, Holston. He's been up and about for maybe 50 years on and off. He told his cultists he was God. And when he woke up next time, they told him he was God, and that little loop has gone round and round until he himself believes it. You see him after they woke you?
Just his people.
Well, believe me, any part of his brain that you might recognise abandoned ship a long time ago.
Lane looked into Holston's face, hunting out any residual sympathy there for the commander.
Seriously, Holston, this is his plan. He wants to put a copy of his brain into the gill. He wants to become the Gill. And you know what? When he's done it, he won't need the cargo. He won't need most of the ship. He won't need life support or anything like that.
He's always had the best interests of the ship at heart, said Holston defensively.
How do you know?
Because it's already happening.
Do you know what the ship was not designed for? Several hundred people living on it for about a century. Wear and tear, Holston. Like you wouldn't believe. A tribe of people who don't know how anything actually works, getting into places they're not supposed to be, buoyed up by their sincere belief that they're doing God's work. Things are falling apart. We're running out of supplies even with what we took from the station. And they just go on eating and fucking because they believe Guyon will lead them to the promised land.
The Green Planet, Holston said softly. Maybe he will.
Oh, sure, Lane scoffed. And that's where we're heading, all right. But unless things get back under control and people go back to the freezer, Guyon will be the only one to get there. Him and a ship full of corpses.
Even if he does manage to upload himself, he'll need people to fix him. Holston wasn't sure precisely why he was defending Nguyen, unless it was that he had long made a profession out of disagreeing with just about every proposition put in front of him. Yeah, well, Lane rubbed at the back of her neck. There was all that auto-repair system business we took from the station. I didn't know about that. It was priority for my team. Seemed like a good idea at the time. I know, conniving at our own obsolescence. It's up and running too, or looks like it. But from what I saw, it's not dealing with the cargo or even most of the systems we need. It's only set up for those parts of the ship Guyan's interested in, the non-living parts. Well, that's the best impression I got before I took my leave. After Nguyen woke you. He wanted me to be part of his grand plan. Only when he gave me access to the Gilgamesh, I found out too much, way too fast. Some seriously cold stuff, Holston, I'll show you. You're still in the system? It's all over the ship, and Nguyen's not good enough to lock me out. Now you're wondering why I haven't screwed him over from inside the computer. Holston shrugged. Well, I was, yes, actually. I told you he's been testing the upload thing. Well, he's had some partial successes. There are things in the system. When I try and cut Nguyen out, or fuck with him, they notice me. They come and start fucking right back. Nguyen I could handle, but these are like retarded little AI programs that think they're still people. And they're Nguyen's, most of them. Most of them? Lane looked unhappy, or rather unhappier. Ah, everything's going to crap, Holston. The Gill's already starting to come apart at the system level. We're on a spaceship, Holston. Have you any idea how fucking complex that is? How many different subsystems need to work properly just to keep us alive? At the moment, it's actually the auto-repair that's keeping everything ticking over, rerouting around the corrupted parts, patching what it can. But it's got limits. Guyan's pushing those limits, diverting resources to his grand immortality project. So we're going to stop him. So, Holston looked from Lane to her crew, the old faces and the new. So, I know about the upload facility, so you got me out. Lane just looked at him for a long moment, fragments of expression burning fitfully across her face. What? She said at last. I'm not allowed to just rescue you, because you're my friend. She held his gaze long enough that he had to look away, obscurely ashamed of what was objectively an entirely reasonable paranoia he felt about her, about Nguyen, and about near enough everything else. Anyway, get yourself cleaned up, get yourself fed, she instructed him. Then you and I have an appointment. Holston's eyebrows went up. With who? Old friends, Lane smiled sourly. The whole gang's together again, old man. How about that?
Chapter 5.2 In God's Country. Portia stretches and flexes her limbs, feeling the newly hardened sheen of her exoskeleton and the constricting net of the cocoon she has woven about herself. The urge came at an inconvenient time, and she put it off as long as she could. But the cramping tightness at every joint had eventually become unbearable, and she was forced to go into retirement, a moon's span of days out of the public eye, fretting and fidgeting as she split her way out of her cramped old skin and let her new skeleton dry out and find its shape. During her lying in, she has been attended by various members of her peer house, which is a dominant force now in Great Nest. There are two or three others who, as a union, could challenge the hold of Portia's family, but they are seldom friends with one another. Portia's agents provocateurs ensure that they are kept constantly fighting over second place. The political realities of Great Nest are finely balanced just now, however. Despite the reports brought to her daily during her lying in, Portia knows there will be dozens of key pieces of information that she will have to catch up with. Thankfully, there is a ready mechanism for doing that. Portia is the greatest priestess of the messenger that Great Nest has, but a month out of circulation will have given many of her sisters ideas. They will have been talking to that fleet, all-important light in the sky, receiving the bizarre, garbled wisdom of the universe and using it for their own benefit. They will have been taking over the grand, often incomprehensible, projects ordered by the voice of God. Portia will have to jostle to recover her old prominence. She descends to the next chamber, a gaggle of younger females attending her. A flicker of her palps and a male is brought in. He has lived a busy month and been present at gatherings that his gender are usually banned from. Everywhere that Portia might have gone, he was brought by her adherents. He has had every missive, every discovery and reversal, every proclamation of God patiently explained to him. He has been well fed, pampered. He has wanted for nothing. Now one of the females brings forward a bulging bulb of silk. Within is the distilled understanding that the last month has added to this male. It comprises an intelligence report which, if delivered in any conventional way, would be interminable in its detail. That single draft contains enough secrets of Portia's peer house to hand Great Nest on a platter to any of her enemies. She drinks, the fluid thick with learning, the bulb held within her palps as she carefully drains its contents before passing it to her subordinates to be destroyed. Already she feels a flutter of discord inside her as the nanovirus she has just ingested begins to fit the purloined knowledge into place within her own mind, accessing the structure of her brain and copying in the male's memories. Within a day and a night she will know all that he knows, and likely she will have lost some unfrequented mental pathways too, some obsolete skill, or distant recollection reconfigured into the new and the necessary. "I will send word about him," she indicates the male. Once she is sure that the new understandings have taken, the male will be disposed of. Killed and eaten by one of Portia's clique. He knows too much, quite literally. Portia's society has come some way since the primitive days when the females ate their mates as often as not, but perhaps not so very far. The killing of males under the protection of another peer house is a crime that demands restitution. The needless killing of any male garners sufficient social disapprobation that it is seldom practiced, and the culprits usually shunned as wasteful and lacking that golden virtue of self-control. However, to kill a male for a good reason, or after coitus, remains acceptable, despite occasional debates on the subject. This is simply the way things are, and the conservation of tradition is important in Great Nest these days. Great Nest is a vast forest metropolis. Hundreds of square kilometres of great trees are festooned with the angled silk dwellings of Portia's kin, constantly being added to and remodelled as each peer house's fortunes advance or decline. The greatest of the spider clans dwell in the mid-level, shielded from the extremes of weather, but suitably distant from the lowly ground where those females without a peer group must fight for legroom with a swarm of half-savage feral males. In between the peer houses are the workshops of artisans, who produce that dwindling stock of items that ants cannot be bred to manufacture. The studios of artists who weave and craft and construct elegant knot script, and the laboratories of scientists of a score of disciplines. Beneath the ground, amongst the roots, crawl the interlocking networks of ants, each nest to its own specialised task. Other larger nests radiate out from the metropolis's limits, engaged in lumberjacking, mining, smelting and industrial manufacture. And, on occasion, war. To fight the other is something that every ant colony can remember how to do, if the need arises, although Great Nest, like its rivals, has specialist soldiers as well. Portia, on her way to Temple, feels fragments of current affairs falling into place within her. Yes, there have been further troubles with Great Nest's neighbours, the Lesser Nests, Seven Trees, River Chasm, Burning Mountain. They are testing the boundaries of territory once again, jealous of the supremacy of Portia's home. It is likely that there will be a new war, but Portia is not concerned about the result. Her people can muster far more ants, and far better designed ants, for the fight ahead. The sheer size of Great Nest necessitates a public transport system in the higher reaches. The central temple where Portia holds sway is some distance from the site of her lying in. She is aware that the transporting of things is the province of God, and among God's troubling, hard-to-understand plans are various means of moving from place to place at great speed. But so far, no peer house, no city, has succeeded in realizing any of them. The spiders have made their own arrangements in the interim, albeit with a cringing awareness that they are inadequate compared to the divine plan. Portia boards a cylindrical capsule that is strung along a thick, braided strand, and lets it carry her at a rushing speed through the arboreal glory that is her home. The motive power is partly stored energy in silk springs, a macro-engineered development drawn from the structure of spider silk itself, and partly cultured muscle. A mindless slab of contracting tissue running along the dorsal rib of the capsule, obliviously hauling itself over and over, efficient, self-repairing, and easy to feed. Great Nest is a complex interconnecting web of such capsule runs, a network amongst networks, like the vibrational communications strands that go everywhere, since the temple maintains a rigorous monopoly on the invisible traces of radio waves. Shortly thereafter, she steps into the temple, carefully marking the reactions of those she finds there, sniffing out potential challengers. "What is the position of the messenger?" she asks, and is told that the voice of God is in the skies, invisible against the daylight. "Let me speak to her." The lesser priestesses clear out of her way somewhat resentfully, having had the run of this place for a month. The old crystal receiver has been improved steadily since the messages of God became comprehensible, that being the first lesson of God, and one of the most successful. Now there is a whole machine of metal and wood and silk that acts as a terminus for a sightless strand of the great and unseen web of the universe that links all such termini, allowing Portia to speak direct to other temples across half the world and to speak to and hear the words of God. After God originally began speaking, it took the combined great minds of several generations to finally learn the divine language, or perhaps to negotiate that language, meeting the comprehension of God halfway. Even now, a certain amount of what God has to say is simply not something that Portia or anyone can understand. It is all set down, though, and sometimes a particularly knotted piece of scripture will yield to the teasing of later theologians. Slowly, however, a rapport with the Godhead was established by Portia's forebears, and the story was thus told. Late in the development of their culture, therefore, Portia's people inherited a creation myth, and had their destiny dictated to them by a being of power and an origin that passed all their understandings. The messenger was the last survivor of an earlier age of the universe, they were told. In the final throes of that age, it was the messenger who was chosen to come to this world and engender life out of the barren earth. The messenger, the goddess of the green planet, remade the world so that it would give rise to that life, next seeded it with plants and trees, and then with the lesser animals. On the last day of the previous age, at the apex of creation, the messenger dispatched Portia's distant ancestors to this world and settled back to await their voices. And after so many generations of silence in which the messenger's voice alone touched the strands of that invisible world-spanning web, the temples now sing back, and the balance of God's plan is parceled out in piecemeal revelations that almost nobody can yet understand. The messenger is trying to teach them how to live, and this involves building machines to accomplish purposes that Portia's people can hardly grasp. It involves dangerous forces, such as the spark that sends signals up the strands of the ether to the messenger, but of a vastly greater power. It involves bizarre, mind-hurting concepts of nested wheels and eyes, fires and channeled lightning. The messenger is trying to help them, but its people are unworthy, so preaches the temple. Why else would they fail their God so often? They must improve and become what God has planned for them. But their manner of life and building and invention is wholly at odds with the vision that the messenger relates to them. Portia and her sisters are often in contact with the temples of other cities, but they are nevertheless drawing apart. God speaks to each of them, each temple being assigned its own frequency, but the message substantially the same, for Portia has eavesdropped on God's dictates to others before. Each temple translates the good news differently, interprets the words and co-opts them to fit with existing mental structures. Worse, some temples are losing their faith entirely, beginning to recast the words of the messenger as something other than divine. This is a heresy, and already there has been conflict. After all, that tiny point of moving light is their only connection to a greater universe which, they are told, they are destined to inherit. To question and alienate that swift star could leave them abandoned and alone in the cosmos. By the end of the day, between reports and the understanding the mail has just gifted to her, she has caught up with what has transpired in her absence. Friction with the apostate Seven Trees Temple is high, and there has been serious infringement at the mine sites. The demands of God mean that raw materials, metals especially, are in high demand. Great Nest has maintained a monopoly of all good veins of iron and copper, gold and silver, anywhere near its ever-extending reach. But other cities constantly dispute this by sending their own ant colonies out in column to raid the workings. It is a war where the weapons, so far, have been more efficiently bred miners rather than fiercer warriors. But Portia is aware that this cannot continue. God herself has stated, in one of those long philosophical diatribes she is partial to, that there is always a single end point to conflict, if neither side will pull back from the brink. Spider has always killed Spider. From the start, the species has had a streak of cannibalism, especially female against male, and they have often struggled for territory, for local dominance. Such killings have never been casual or common, however. The nanovirus that runs through each of them forms another web of connections, reminding each of the sentience of the other. Even males partake. Even their little deaths have a meaning and a significance that cannot be denied. Certainly, the spiders have never fallen so far as to practice widespread slaughter. They have reserved their wars for defending themselves against extra species threats, such as that long-ago war against the ant supercolony that in the end proved such a boost for their technology. For a species that thinks naturally in terms of interconnected networks and systems, the idea of a war of conquest and extermination, rather than a campaign of conversion, subversion, and co-option, does not come easily. God has other ideas, however, and the superiority of God's ideas has become a major point of dogma for the temple. After all, why would anyone need a temple otherwise? When she is finally on top of developments both theological and political, when she has been capsuled out of the city limits to visit the divine workshops where her priest engineers labour to try and make real something, anything, from God's perplexing designs, only then does she find time for a personal errand. For Portia, personal and priestly are almost always interwoven. But in this she is indulging herself, finding time to meet with one little mind amongst so many, and yet such a jewel of clarity. Several of the key moments of epiphany, in which God's message was untangled even slightly, have originated with this remarkable brain. And yet she feels a tug of shame in spending her time in travelling to this little remarked laboratory, where her unacknowledged protégé is given the chance to experiment and build without the rigid control that the temple traditionally exerts. She enters without fanfare, finding the object of her curiosity studying the latest results, a complex notation of chemical analysis woven automatically by one of the ant colonies of the city. Interrupted by her presence, the scientist turns and waves palps in complex genuflection, a dance of respect, subservience, and pleading. "Fabian," she addresses him, and the male shivers and bobs. Before coming here, Portia has been to the outer laboratories to view the progress on God's plan, and she is not heartened. The history of the messenger's contact with her chosen is the enactment of a plan. Once the language barrier was breached, as it is still being breached, missive to missive, God wasted no time in establishing her place in the cosmos. There was at the time some debate amongst the scholars, but against a voice from the stars that promised them a universe grander than anything they had imagined, what could the skeptics suggest? The fact of God was inarguable.
That it served the temple to argue God's corner is something Portia is aware of. She is aware that the first reaching out to God was a defying of temple edicts of the time.